This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Before she had graduated from UVM, Keisha Rahm was already running to represent Burlington in the State House. She was elected to the Vermont House of Representatives in 2008 and has served four terms. Now she's setting her sights on higher office. She's one of three Democrats competing for the party's nomination in the August 9th primary, and she's the second in our series of interviews with those candidates. We will look at her time in the legislature, her priorities for the state moving forward, and how she would shape the role of lieutenant governor. Keisha Rahm, it's nice to have you back on the program.
Always great to be with you, Jane.
Why do you want to be lieutenant governor?
So in my legislative career and outside, I have been a champion for fighting to protect Vermont families. I started my legislative career also working as a preschool teacher. And as a Head Start advocate, I saw families that were struggling with hunger and eviction and what that did to the kids in our preschool, the strife that they faced and the stress that they went through while they were trying to be early learners. I then spent the next 3 years as a social worker for victims of domestic violence and helped victims navigate our social service programs, our judicial system, and try to gain access to justice, whether it was in the police station in the middle of the night or in our correctional facilities, and have really spent my time in the legislature trying to do the same work, really thinking about what our Vermont families are facing, how we give them access into the middle class, and how we support Vermonters to thrive, to succeed. And as I really see it now, after 8 years in the legislature, what we're continuing to see is that Vermont families are continuing to take a Vermont discount on their wages while they're paying a Vermont premium on their cost of living. And it's unsustainable.
So how, as lieutenant governor, would you take those issues and move them forward and try to address some of the concerns that you have?
Well, I've always been that social worker, that advocate, the person who tries to bring stakeholders together to solve common challenges. And I have always in the legislature brought a long-term vision to those challenges. How can we get beyond party lines and partisan rhetoric to really solve our problems, whether it's taking on first-time homebuyer tax incentives or renewable energy siting as vice chair of natural resources and energy or access to early childhood education?
But you don't have the platform to propose the legislation or to move the legislation forward when you're lieutenant governor. So what would you actually do to make those things change?
I see the role of lieutenant governor as having the most opportunity to be connector in chief for Vermonters, to bringing stakeholders together year round, to doing that casework. And, you know, I was just before I joined you talking to a small business owner in Brattleboro, Michael Alexander at Recycle Away. And, you know, what he was saying was that what Montpelier has to recognize is there's all these programs, there's all these opportunities to help businesses, but they're really busy, they're really stressed, and they don't have the opportunity to take advantage of it if they have to fill out a lot of paperwork or put in that extra time and effort. And having someone in that role who's been a caseworker, a social worker, whether it's for Vermont's families or small businesses, fighting to advocate for them and protect them, is a role that I can really play year-round.
We're talking with Keisha Rahm. She's running for the Democratic nomination for lieutenant governor. And listeners, what do you want to know about her priorities and how she would shape the position? You can call in and ask about broadband access, taxes, the economy, health care. What do you think the top priority is for the state, and what do you want to know about how Keisha Rahm would take on the role of lieutenant governor? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Andrea calling in from Peacham. Hi, Andrea. Go right ahead.
Hi, Keisha. Before looking into the race, I, you know, want to say honestly that I hadn't really heard much about you. So when I did some research, I was a little concerned when I checked out your voting record on tobacco. As a breast cancer survivor myself and the daughter of a firefighter who died of lung disease, and also someone who's coordinated and facilitated tobacco cessation programs, I'm wondering why you voted against raising the age of tobacco sales from 18 to 21, why you're against taxing e-cigarettes, and against raising taxes on tobacco sales.
Andrea, thanks for the call. Keisha Rahm?
Thank you for the question, Andrea, and I appreciate you calling in as a survivor as well. I do not oppose tackling our tobacco issue in the state. I want to see it be done holistically. And as folks may know from my time in the legislature, What we know doesn't work, and the American Cancer Society knows this as well, is nickel and diming tobacco users to fill budget gaps. And that's what we've been doing for the last several years in the legislature. So again, when we're talking about punishing smokers or taking the ability for them to have access away, we have to couple that with programs that help them quit and don't just raise penalties on young people who try to get access to tobacco. And when you think about the $60 million a year that we collect in tobacco taxes, I would believe that at least a good portion of that could go to cessation and prevention. And folks may not know this, but of that $60 million, about $500,000, less than $1 million, goes to the Department of Health for cessation and prevention. We are relying heavily on tobacco settlement funds, and we are not putting that money that we're extracting from smokers back into helping them quit. And to me, that's levying a regressive tax on usually people who are poor and suffer from mental health issues without helping them quit. When we take away people's choices or tax them more, we should be giving them the opportunity to change their behavior. And I don't see the state doing a good enough job of that. So to me, it's not a solution to simply tax our way out of the problem.
And you feel the same way about raising the smoking age from 18 to 21, which was an issue that came up in the last session?
Not only were we talking about raising the smoking age, but increasing the penalties on young people who try to access cigarettes. These are probably people who are struggling to make ends meet with multiple jobs, who may have mental health issues of their own, who aren't getting the services that they need, and we were going to levy additional penalties on those folks. I just think that's the wrong approach to the problem. When I stood on the House floor with an amendment that would have taken 5% of that $60 million and put it towards cessation and prevention, that we couldn't do that, and yet we could choose to levy more penalties against young people.
When you started your term in the Vermont House, you mentioned that you were a preschool teacher. And one of the things that you have said is a priority for you moving forward, should you be lieutenant governor, is early childhood education. We already have universal pre-K for Vermont kids ages 3 and up. So what is it that you'd like to see that the state could be doing more of?
Well, as you mentioned, we did create access to universal pre-K ages 3 and up, which is a great start. It's a guarantee of 10 hours in any district that you live in. And that leaves a lot of opportunity for continuing to grow that opportunity. One would be trying to ensure that kids 0 to 3 have those same early learning opportunities. We have a lot of families who really can't make the choice right now between childcare and getting a job that pays them well. The second they take on more work, they lose their childcare subsidy. I've talked to hotel owners who say they have folks working for them who say, can you cut my hours to back to 25? Because if I work more, I lose my childcare subsidy. And that's an unfortunate choice that Vermonters are making, particularly in that 0 to 3 category. And we know that's a critical age to get our early learners off to a good start, to make sure they have at least 2 to 3 meals a day, that they have a nurturing environment. I remember working as a preschool teacher, and we had a young boy who had multilingual parents and, you know, needed a lot of support and resources. And about halfway through his time in the preschool, we realized he was deaf. And in any other environment, that might not have been discovered until much later. And so having those interventions, having people who are able to help our kids at an early age is critical. Now, we've just done what I think is valuable work in asking our early childhood educators to meet greater quality standards and to have greater education, but we need to help support them in that. It's going to be expensive, and for some, there's the possibility perhaps of doing what the federal government tried to do years ago and forgive some of their college debt or their educational debt for trying to meet the standards that we've put in place. So how do we create a system that's really holistic in thinking about what early childhood educators need to be successful?
You also mentioned that higher education is something that you're concerned about, and there are several proposals on the table from candidates for governor about college affordability. It's an issue that's come up in national campaigns as well. How would you support efforts to increase college affordability, and are there any plans that you endorse?
Thank you for the question. You know, I think some of the plans center around kind of a promise scholarship. If you stay and do well, and go into public service, we'll help forgive some of your debt. The problem with a proposal like that is that it doesn't work for a lot of low-income families who feel the stress of having to take on loans in the first place and don't know what their future holds, don't know how they're going to have to support their families. And so usually they aren't able to take advantage of those programs. You know, I know there's another proposal out there to fund access to community college and do that through a bank franchise fee. Now, we did
that's
just...
That's Sue Minter's plan.
That's right. Yeah, Sue Minter. We did just raise the bank franchise fee, and I think community college is a great, and our technical college, great place to create that access. And there may be other special programs and opportunities that our young people want to take advantage of at our full range of colleges. So for me, I look at the way we crafted our dual enrollment and early college program, and I was very happy to be part of that work. And what we know, and I sat with Congressman Welch and a number of families to talk about how that program is doing, and it's working. It's not just high flyers and high achievers. It's the single moms who are going back to school. It's the families who are struggling to put three kids through college, and they're able to get ahead by helping their kids, there are Vermont students in high school, get access to the beginnings of a college education. And some of them are able to do over a year of college while they're still in high school and get that head start. And let's keep investing in that program, because there's not enough investment there for every young person to be able to take advantage of that. But let's expand that program so we can guarantee our young people in Vermont access to two full free years of college education.
While we're talking about education, let's go back to the middle. So we've tackled pre-K education and higher education. What's your position on consolidating Vermont schools and school districts and the right number of Vermont schools?
So, Jane, the bill, in my view, was always about consolidating districts and not schools. And I think that is what is really catching us up on Act 46. And it's frustrating, because when we were debating the bill and when I supported the bill, I really had in mind what superintendents told us were situations where you have two middle or high schools not very far apart. And one has AP classes, one has music classes, but kids are losing opportunity at both. And trying to turn that around and make sure that we have high schools that are robust, that kids get all of the opportunities they need to be college ready and to graduate with the support that they need to get ahead. And what I didn't envision, and what many of us didn't envision, was this would mean we're putting elementary school kids on a bus to get to school. Our elementary schools are the hearts of our communities, and in many ways, it's where you catch issues early, you have your unique special education programs, you have a community that wraps its arms around those schools. And, you know, I think there are ways to think about how we share resources and consolidate districts without requiring us to close small schools. In fact, some of the most visionary superintendents we spoke with were ones who helped small schools thrive in a larger district. So those are the conversations I want to have. And, you know, we had a two-hour debate on the caps in Act 46.
These are the spending caps.
The spending caps. Thank you. Toward the end of that 2 hours, I got up and I just said, you know, we've had a really long debate and we haven't really talked about kids. And let's start talking about quality education for kids and language academies, magnet schools, getting outside of a classroom with four walls, and really living up to our full potential of offering every student quality education.
But you mentioned earlier the pressures on parents, and some of those include the cost of property taxes. And so if what you're saying is we don't need to close any small schools despite declining enrollment, do we reach a point where we can't reduce property taxes anymore, even though we have perhaps schools where there is a continually declining enrollment and not enough kids to merit the student-teacher ratio that would be required to be had at a school?
Well, I absolutely want to talk about property tax relief and affordability, but even the Agency of Education is backing away from coupling bending the cost curve on property taxes with closing small schools or changing the configuration of our districts. There are incentives to help schools do that are going to cost taxpayers money. And in the long term, I think we should be focusing much more on quality education for young people and making sure we do the right thing by them than figuring out if we're going to close this school and bus those kids to another location, or what that district is now going to do for their elementary school and middle school kids. Let's have the conversation about quality, and I believe the rest will follow. And let's have a separate conversation about property taxes and bending that cost curve, because what we know is that Vermont is particularly reliant on property taxes over other kinds of taxes to fund education.
Okay, so let's have that conversation then. If what you're saying is we don't need to close any schools and we can find other sources of revenue to keep them open, what are those sources? Where would you go if not to rely primarily on the property tax?
So we look at the education fund also being financed by the sales tax. Our sales tax hasn't changed since its inception. It was supposed to be a luxury tax on goods that now are necessities for folks. And what we don't actually tax is the services that have become much more of a luxury. It used to be it was a luxury to have a lawnmower. Now it's a luxury to have a lawn care service. And so, you know, let's look at restructuring our whole tax system in the context of what does quality education look like and what does a budget look like that's whole for Vermonters, and work backwards into looking at what tax reform proposals make the most sense. Do we transition the sales tax into the 21st century? Do we move from taxable income to adjusted gross income so we're not tied to all the federal loopholes that make our income tax particularly volatile? But let's have a conversation about our tax structure, and let's have a separate conversation about if we were building an education system today, how we would provide the best education to our kids.
Is that something that you would address as Lieutenant Governor? It's certainly the economy and taxes and the pressures on Vermont families have been the main focus, if not the sole focus, but one of the main focuses of the current Lieutenant Governor, Phil Scott, who's running now for governor. Is the economy something that you would be focusing on?
Well, you know, there are two things that I talk to a lot of my colleagues about, and they can be of all political stripes and backgrounds. And one is that tax reform policy and making our tax system more stable. And in a lot of ways, you can do that and potentially lower the tax rate if you're changing the base that you're taxing. But let's talk about that base. And the second proposal that we always discuss is how you grow it. And, you know, I've worked for Mayor Weinberger in local government where we're really trying to grow that base in Burlington. We know we've gone from, you know, a very limited number of hotels and, you know, points of access for tourists to really growing what the tax base looks like. And we need to be doing that statewide. What we know is with economic development, we focus a lot on startups and new entrepreneurs. And 80% of economic growth comes from helping small businesses grow into medium-sized and larger businesses. And I'm talking to businesses all the time that are 5 to 15 people who say, where is the person coming by to help me grow even larger? And we could have those businesses and companies here that help us grow that base so we're not constantly nickel and diming folks for new revenue.
We got a note from Mark who says, in terms of education, the real question for Representative Rahm is whether she thinks the student-to-staff ratio in schools needs to be increased from nearly 5-to-1 to something like 7-to-1 or 10-to-1 so that we can make public education in Vermont more affordable for taxpayers.
So there's a lot of different ratios we can talk about, paraeducators, teacher-to-student ratio, administrator-to-student ratio. And I think what you'll see is that it differs depending on the district. And I think what Act 46 has demonstrated to us is we needed to have the political courage to have a conversation in Montpelier, but now the Board of Education and our local districts need to have that conversation among themselves. There's only so much we can mandate from Montpelier with trying to make 276 different districts and configurations dance on the head of a pin like angels. We need to let our districts do their work and come up with the ratio that makes sense for them. But maybe what that looks like in Montpelier is figuring out if we continue to implement small school grants, if we continue to subsidize small schools at a rate that most Vermonters can't afford.
We also got a note from VT5150, who was listening to you talk about taxes and says, service tax? Are you kidding me? Has she ever met a tax she didn't like?
Well, I appreciate the comment, and I have met a tax I didn't like. I spent 3 years on Ways and Means and worked with colleagues from a range of backgrounds on trying to figure out what makes the most sense for our long-term future, not just thinking about we need $10 or $15 million of revenue. How do we extract that from Vermonters this year? But what does our long-term vision look like for a 21st century economy? How do we close some of the tax loopholes that currently exist and move to a tax structure where we then make expenditures on the right things? So, for example, we still have Vermonters who deduct their gambling losses from their income tax, and yet we charge a tax on textbooks for college students. Are we making the right decisions with our tax structure overall, and how do we look at that bigger picture?
We're talking with Keisha Rahm. She's one of the candidates for lieutenant governor running in the Democratic primary on August 9th, and she's part in our series of interviews with candidates facing primary challenges. If you have a question for the Burlington Democrat who's been serving in the Vermont House for the past 8 years, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're in the middle of a series of three Meet the Candidate interviews with the Democrats running for lieutenant governor in Vermont's August 9th primary. The winner will face Republican Randy Brock in the general election. And today we're talking with Keisha Rahm. She's served in the Vermont House for the last 8 years. If you have a question for her, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Keisha Rahm, over the last 48 hours, there have been two very high-profile incidents where police officers killed black civilians in this country. And there have been several cases of officer-involved shootings in Vermont in recent months, although not necessarily with the same heightened racial dynamics. I understand that's something that you're interested in addressing as a politician and as a candidate for lieutenant governor.
Yes. Thank you, Jane, for bringing that up, because I think it's hard for many people to get through their day without thinking of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, the two men who were shot and killed in officer-involved shootings in the last 48 hours. It's an issue that's near and dear to me as a person of color, as someone who grew up in my Indian immigrant father and Jewish American mother's Irish pub, and you know, had a lot of folks say to my Indian immigrant father, go back to Mexico, or have him pulled over and run for stolen plates more times than he could remember. And so what we know is that communities of color are really facing an epidemic in this country. And they live in Vermont, and it may not be a Vermont encounter that they've had, but they carry that with them from wherever they come from. And we know that this is also a Vermont issue we have to address. Our officers put themselves in harm's way and try to do the best job they can. But we also have to recognize that we know from great work at VPR and other reporting and data collection that we have a disparity in black men's experience in roadside stops and searches. And for every one black man out of 100 people in Vermont who's walking freely in our state, 14 out of 100 men in our prison population are black. And so we are part of this racial disparity that we see in the country, and it's something we have to address. And I've spent a lot of time in my legislative career working on fair and impartial policing, trying to ensure that we have the right data to paint a picture, but also that we get more qualitative, that we figure out what is actually going on with our officers in these incidences, and how do we address that in our police academy through training opportunities, and how do we work to stop that pipeline from starting in our schools. I've also introduced legislation to try and work on our rate of students being expelled and suspended, because we know that when we look there, we see a higher proportion of students with disabilities and students of color face punitive measures in school that they carry with them for a lifetime. You know, the sad reality is what we hear when men like these two get killed is, well, they had a record. And, you know, they were a danger to society. And there's a lot of institutional racism wrapped up in who has a record and what their experience is in the criminal justice system. And those are things that we need to be addressing in Vermont and doing a better job of as well.
So, again, in the role of lieutenant governor, what would you do? I mean, is this something where you're trying to create more awareness through talking, or are there actual initiatives that you think you can do? Because this is a role that, again, comes with no power to craft legislation, no real budgetary expenditures, no mandate that you have in that sense. So how do you address that issue and move it as lieutenant governor?
Well, Jane, I think you bring up a good point, because this is a cultural shift that we need to make. It's not simply something you can legislate away. And in my last 8 years in the legislature, having worked on these issues, many people have come to me individually and said, we have a new officer of color in our department who's really struggling to when they experience hostility from either the people they're serving or fellow officers. Can you help us? Can you work with us? Or somebody is, you know, stopped by the police and they're terrified. They don't have access to a lawyer. And just ask me if I can support them and walk them through this and maybe advocate for them. And, you know, that work happens all the time to try and say, who is experiencing this? What does that look like? How can we move from the anecdotal to the empirical, but also recognize that it's relationship building that it takes as well?
We got a note from Miles in Worcester who emailed in yesterday to say, what kinds of gun control legislation would you look to support for Vermont?
Yeah, so, you know, Jane, when we were doing our last major gun initiative, which was trying to keep guns out of the hands of abusers in the case of domestic violence situations, and just follow federal law that says those weapons should be taken away and stored for the duration of a protection order, I was really leading the charge on that. I've worked with victims of domestic violence. I've seen the terror that strikes a victim when they know that somebody has access to weapons and they're trying to serve divorce paperwork or get a protection order, because someone can walk right through that piece of paper and they know that that's when they're at the highest danger. And so it's an issue that's very near and dear to me. I have been a sponsor of universal background check legislation. I stand with a majority of gun owners in believing that we should close loopholes for gun shows and for internet sales and make sure that everyone goes through a background check to access a weapon.
Again, when we talk about universal background checks, that word universal gets thrown around, but there are, people mean different things by it. So do you mean as well that family members who pass along guns to other family members should also be subject to that universal background check law?
Well, you know, when we did our domestic violence work on gun safety, you know, we really looked hard at what access to guns looks like. And, you know, when I'm sitting in a courtroom with a victim and, you know, the defendant says, well, I'll give my guns to my uncle and he'll only let me take them out to go shooting, that's not a particularly safe situation for those victims of domestic violence. So, you know, while we worked in that situation to try to make accommodations, we had to find common ground. It was about saying, can that family member at least fill out an affidavit and talk about how they're going to store them, or be, you know, somewhere on record with how that whole transaction is going to proceed? Because, you know, those can still be situations that are dangerous for victims of domestic violence, who we know make up a majority of our gun-related homicides in the state.
But to the specific question about universal background checks on transfer of firearms from one family member to another, is that something you support?
You know, I think a lot of things happen informally, and I don't want to create laws that we can't enforce. So my focus would be on working through the issues where we know, you know, people are majority getting those guns through gun shows or on the internet. And that is going to be my priority. I mean, I really think when it comes to storage and when it comes to family members giving weapons to other family members, we're not going to go into homes and police people to that level. It's going to be about common sense gun safety.
Let's go to Tom, who's calling in from South Hero. Hi, Tom. Go right ahead.
Hi, Keisha.
Hi, Tom.
This is Tom, and I'd like to ask, as facilitator in chief, how you foresee you could help implement greater expanse in terms of renewable energy projects, particularly grid-sized projects, expanding beyond what Vermont's done in the past with emphasizing on residential solar installs. Because with a grid as small as 1,240 megawatts a year, and given how smart Vermont's grid is, one of the smartest in the country, I don't see why Vermont can't become a leader to show the world that you don't have to be a sunny or particularly windy place to get the lion's share of your energy from renewables.
Tom, thanks for the call.
Yeah, Tom, that's a great question. And I've served for the last year as vice chair of natural resources and energy. So, you know, this question and this work has come up a lot because we're creating thousands of new jobs in our renewable energy industry. It's one of our fastest growing sectors. And there's a lot more we can be doing to incentivize that growth. You know, number one, what that looks like is supporting those businesses. And I was just with a solar developer in the Upper Valley who was saying, you know, I have a company of 10, 15 people, and we're getting a grant from the federal government to help make us more efficient. And we're looking to do cutting edge work nationally. And the state could be doing a lot more just to check in with us and ask, you know, the right questions. And what that looked like for him was thinking about contracts with the state, thinking about where they could do more development that was in partnership with the state, and how, as you said, we develop that grid and work with our utilities so that they are preferencing local companies when doing that work. I was proud to work this year on our renewable energy siting bill. And I think what's important about that is it's about meeting our 90% renewable energy goal by 2050 and doing it in a way that communities have a lot of ownership and choice in the process. And when you ask communities what they want, it is often to work on efficiency and rooftop solar. It's helping everybody lower their electricity bills directly and then moving into larger solar fields and other generation. But, you know, those are the kinds of things that can help us stop pipelines from needing to be developed and move away from fossil fuels if we can do more to incentivize that direct access to the grid, help people build solar on their rooftops. And now the new Public Service Board net metering rules are really preferencing those solar panels going on hard and fast locations, on people's roofs, on roofs of barns, on landfill sites, in quarries. And that's the kind of work that we want to be incentivizing and do more of.
Let's go to another Tom who's calling in from Barnett. Hi, Tom. Go right ahead.
Hi. I recently received a phone call from someone purporting to be conducting a poll regarding the lieutenant governor's race in Vermont. Actually, they were conducting what's known as a push poll. I won't explain what that is unless you think I really need to. I assume you know what a push poll is.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the information provided in this push poll was concerning Keisha. And I would like to ask the candidate whether or not she or anyone on her behalf is conducting any kind of push polling on her behalf.
Keisha Rahm?
Well, I think it is important to define push-pull in this context because, you know, to my knowledge, those really do focus on yes or no, good or bad. You know, do you know this person's name? And we did have a poll in the field. We're running a statewide campaign. We really want to know what matters to Vermonters. But I think in my definition, it was nowhere near what would be considered a push poll. It was a really long-range, positive poll just focused on, you know, my message, my story, and how that's going to resonate with Vermonters. You know, I start in this race as the underdog. I haven't had as many years on this earth as the other candidates and have more of a uphill climb when it comes to name recognition. But what we know is that when people hear my story as a preschool teacher, a social worker, someone who's fought for Vermont families, we are successful and it resonates with Vermonters who are facing an opiate addiction crisis, who want to see their communities thrive and grow, who want small businesses to thrive and survive in Vermont. And so getting that message out there has been my focus. And, you know, that's what we're doing in this race, and we're really enjoying it.
How much are you spending on that poll?
I don't have the figure. You know, I rely on a great team that I have. And, you know, we know that a lot of campaigns are focusing on the science of how you reach Vermonters. And I've even had some folks come into our office and say, I got your poll and it inspired me about your story to come in and make phone calls for you and work on the campaign. And so, you know, we've just taken it as an opportunity to fold into our campaign that message, that story, what's resonating with Vermonters.
Keisha Rahm is a Democrat running for her party's nomination to be the next lieutenant governor. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Jane. And if people want to learn more about me, they can go to KeishaRahm.com, KeishaRahm.com. Thanks so much.
We also have a link to Keisha's website at vpr.net, where you can also listen to yesterday's interview with Shap Smith. And tomorrow we'll be talking with the third candidate in that primary race, David Zuckerman. You can send your questions for him to vermontedition@vpr.net. Coming up, forget weeding by hand. Why not try weeding by duckling? We'll explain next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont farmers are nothing if not adventurous in trying to develop new uses for their land. One farmer in Addison County converted some of his farm into rice paddies. Not only that, but he's incorporated the help of ducklings to keep the crop healthy. VPR's Rick Sangari visited Bound Brook Farm in Ferrisburg to learn more about this symbiotic relationship.
Several hundred ducks are paddling in a rice paddy on Eric Andrus's farm. And if you're thinking that rice isn't typically grown in Addison County, you're right. But Andrus has found a way to make rice work here.
Rice is a tropical plant, and even though the varieties we grow are cold tolerant, they don't grow as fast as they do in a tropical environment. So grows very slowly, and there's a lot of space between the plants, and it's very wet and fertile, and it's a condition where weeds can really flourish. And also, because it's flooded, it's very difficult to get in there with any type of equipment and pull the weeds or cultivate them in any way.
And that's where the ducks come in.
So the duck is a perfect fit for this problem because they can walk or swim between the plants, and they eat the weeds and bugs that bother the rice crop, but they do not harm the rice plants because rice leaves contain silica, and ducks don't like the feel of that in their bills. So they leave the rice leaves alone. By the time the rice plants are developing grain, we remove them from the field because the ducks will eat that. But by that time, they've done 6 weeks of field cleaning for us free of charge.
Andrus learned this method of using ducks to tend to his rice paddies by visiting farmers in Japan who've perfected the technique. He now has 400 ducks that he bought as hatchlings.
And they are khaki Campbell ducks, so they're a small, agile, domestic duck. They're not perfect for your great big Peking duck a l'orange, but they are good egg layers, and they're adept foragers. So even at 10 days old, today they are 10 days old, they can go out to the field and stay there as long as we can protect them from predators.
Today, these young ducklings will paddle in water for the first time in the rice paddies.
We're going to take the ducklings from the brooder to the rice field in the tractor, and this method puts the ducks in a great big jumble in a bin just for a few minutes for their ride to the field, and then they get unceremoniously dumped into the rice paddy. That's how the Japanese do it, so I know it works. They'll sort themselves out in a matter of minutes, and they'll be off and foraging for weeds and bugs and tadpoles and whatever else they can find out there.
Well, ducks, remember your training.
Andrus lifts two dark blue plastic bins from the tractor, each carrying 60 ducklings. The ducklings hop and tumble out of the bins at the edge of the rice paddy. The ducks are swimming for the first time. One older mallard is with them, showing them how, but mostly they're just trying to get out of each other's way.
Is this the first moment of their life that they've been in water?
Yeah. That's it. That's the magic right there.
Notice how the water is clouding right away. That also helps keep weeds from germinating on the soil bed and makes more nutrients available for the growing rice plants. You can actually see the cloud spreading right around the ducks into the clear water right next to the ducks. But by the end of the day, they'll have muddied up this entire rice paddy.
While rice is his crop, it's clear that Andrus cares about the ducks that help him grow the rice. He says it's his responsibility to keep the ducks healthy and feels a bond with them.
So I talk with my ducklings all the time. I call to them. And even though they can get their own food, make a practice of calling them and feeding them a little bit of duck food every day so that they always come when I call. Yeah.
Oh, duck, duck, duck. Duck, duck, duck.
It's so funny that they're just getting familiar with the surroundings.
Yeah.
You know, they're afraid to go too far.
What really makes ducks healthy in a 24/7 outdoor environment is the fact that, like, the duck is a creature that lives on the edge of water and land. So in order for it to really work, the water level in the field has to be quite low, lower than most rice farmers are comfortable with. But if they're in deep water all the time, they are not big enough to temperature regulate, and they'll succumb to various diseases.
Andrus works to balance the health of the ducks with the productivity of the rice paddies. His farm now produces 3 to 4 tons of rice, 3 Japanese varieties, and 1 Russian variety.
When I first bought this farm about 10 years ago, we aimed to actually grow wheat and barley and other dryland crops, but we have very heavy soils, and 2 years out of 3, the rainfall patterns, which have been meaning we get fewer shots of rain and larger shots, have made for difficult cropping conditions 2 years out of 3. And I lived in Japan 16 or so years ago, and I saw commercial scale rice being grown there. And when we saw water pooling in the fields, like a foot deep, my wife and I would joke like, oh, we ought to be growing rice. And then in 2010, we heard about this couple in southern Vermont that had been doing experiments with Japanese cold-tolerant rice varieties. And it started not to be a joke. It's like, oh, we ought to be growing rice. And so I learned about the research that Takeshi and Linda Akaogi had done and decided that I wanted to create a small commercial-scale model for Japanese rice varieties. There's an awful lot New Englanders don't know about growing rice, and some of it we've been able to learn from books, and a lot of it we've learned from trial and error. And last year, I went to Japan and made a connection with some of the ecological rice-growing community in Japan, and that was enormously helpful. So we're getting closer and closer to a really viable model. But the climate and the soils are an excellent fit. The Champlain Valley was naturally a combination of wetlands and wet forest, so rice is a much better fit for what the valley wants to be in terms of natural history than corn or wheat.
Andrus likes to say that if the Champlain Valley had been colonized by people from Asia instead of Europeans, we'd already have several hundred years of rice-growing tradition here. For VPR News, I'm Rick Singeri in Ferrisburg.
If you've been following the news about Brexit or refugee migration across Europe or even the American presidential contest, you've heard people refer to nationalism as an emerging theme. Nationalism can be seen by some as a philosophy of protection and by others as a divisive and destructive force. VPR classical host James Stewart is giving us an entirely different way to think about nationalism through music.
Music is one of the ways that we define ourselves. Beginning around the 19th century, we're able to think about composers not along lines of genre or form, but along lines of nationality. For instance, when we think of Chopin, we immediately think of Poland. When we think of Edvard Grieg, we think of Norway. With Sibelius, it's Finland. With Dvorak, it's Bohemia. These composers are just a few examples of a movement we call musical nationalism. This movement sought to evoke specific ethnicities or regions through music. Composers of the 19th century would often incorporate folk songs or melodies into larger works, paint sound pictures of recognizable landmarks, or use an overtly regional or political subject matter for their operas or symphonic poems. Musical nationalism mirrored the political movements of the day. The early 18th century saw the rise of the American and French revolutions and the decline of empire in the Western world. The aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars at the dawn of the next century left a blossoming desire for freedom and independence among many nations in Europe. They chose to define their countries not by dynasties, government, or religion, but by the people of the land itself. These political movements sought to inspire patriotism, a love for the land, its people, its mother tongue, and especially its art and culture. In music, the classical era was marked by a homogeneous metropolitan style, a true melting pot of Europe. Mozart's work fits this description well. It's hard to say that his music is from any one specific region. The entire 18th century was dominated by composers from Germany, France, and Italy, most composing in similar forms and styles. But in the Romantic era, composers were less interested in form and precision than they were with emotions and identity. The Romantics sought to define themselves by their country and by the sounds and songs of the people who lived there. Bedřich Smetana brought the folk songs and land of Bohemia into the concert hall. Bartók and Kodály championed the folk music of Hungary. Alexander Borodin and Rimsky-Korsakov took European instruments and expressed Russian sentiments. All around the world, composers sought to express their identity not in their relationship to previous masters or works, but by their homeland. This artistic desire is still felt today. Every culture has its own songs, instruments, harmonies, and rhythms that serve to identify or evoke its people and its way of life. Our music is one of the ways that we define ourselves and where we come from.
That's VPR classical host James Stewart. This story aired in his series, Timeline, which explores the development of Western music. Timeline is made possible in part by a grant from the Ida and William Rosenthal Foundation. Earlier this hour, we talked with Keisha Rahm about her bid for the Democratic nomination for lieutenant governor. Tomorrow, one of her opponents, David Zuckerman, will be our guest. He's better known as a progressive state senator and farmer, but we'll learn tomorrow why he's running in the three-way Democratic contest. Send your questions for Zuckerman to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. And you can listen back to our conversations with Keisha Rahm and with Chap Smith. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Our program is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone, with production assistance from Jake Burstein. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.